Well, before starting my sharing, which is what I've been asked to give, so it's not really a formal Dhamma talk, it's more like just a few words of my own personal experience and perhaps some of my hopes and aspirations that I want to share with you. And then any comments are welcome. These are my own personal feelings, and some of them are rather critical, but I'm going to voice them anyways. But I'd like to start off by saying that about a week ago or so, a little more than a week ago, Selena took myself and Bhante Yai to Kailaksi. I'd been there once before, and I didn't realize the reaction I would have there, you know. So obviously, I'm not free from views and attachment, because I had a reaction when I went there. I was really turned off. And this huge multi-million-dollar bronze Kuan Yin with this carved column tower, you know, I don't know how many millions of dollars that has cost. And as we went around the temple, I noticed that there's Shakyamuni Buddha, the historical Buddha, Gautama Buddha, is almost completely absent. You see Kuan Yin? I mean, Kuan Yin has really replaced the Buddha. Kuan Yin, Vairochana Buddha, Samanta Bahadra, Manjushri, Amitabha Buddha. And I was wondering, well, if that's the case, what has happened to the Buddha's teachings? Why do people go there? Do they go there just to pray to Kuan Yin? Kuan Yin, please help me. I need a promotion in my job. You know, I want to buy a new car, you know. Please help me, Kuan Yin. You know, I'd like to get together with such and such a person. Can you help me, Kuan Yin? You know, I'm willing to make a donation if you can help me. But I thought back, what are the Buddha's teachings? If we went and we asked the Buddha to do something, what would the Buddha say? The Buddha said, I can only set an example. You have to help yourself. That is the fundamental teaching of the Buddha, is we have to be responsible for ourselves. We can't lay it all on someone else and say, like, well, God told me to do it, or the devil told me to do it, or, you know, Krishna told me to do it. And I'm not kidding. I happen to know of a murder that was committed in the name of Krishna. Actually, the Mahabharata. The Mahabharata is a story of a war between the Pandavas and the Kauravas. And then Krishna justifies this war. But, you know, he says you have to fight for righteousness. On the other hand, I mean, it was a slaughter. You know, many, many people died, and just a few of the Pandavas were left. But on the other hand, this story may also be a simile. We have to understand, you know, that these type of spiritual odysseys are also symbolic of an inner quest, an inner spiritual warfare, battle that we have to fight with the forces of evil within our own minds, our own mental defilements. But anyways, this was in West Virginia, where it was New Brindavan, Hare Krishna group. The leader told somebody, look, this person is evil. I want you to kill him. And he said, look. Well, the man didn't want to do it. He said, look, it's in the, you know, it's in our scriptures. It's justified. If you're righteous and that person is evil, Krishna has given you his blessings. Actually, I don't know what happened to the person who killed him, but I know the leader's in jail. He went to jail. He did kill him. Anyways, I'm getting a little off track here. So then a few days later, also while I was there, some young girl wanted to come up and take a photo of me. And I, you know, tourists. And I didn't plan it out. But because of the way I was feeling, I said, no. I just didn't want to be part of their marketing ploy, you know, part of their advertising, you know, to get money. I mean, it's a big, big money-making enterprise. Millions of dollars. Yes. So I thought, what has Buddhism come to, you know, the teachings of the Buddha? Then on Vesak Day, we went down to see the parade. The whole celebration was, on one level, I think it was good for lay people, but for a person like myself, I found it superficial. Noisy and parades. As I said to Wong, I said, you know, if you want to see an extravaganza, I said, you should go to Carnival in Rio de Janeiro. Then you'll really see some floats. I said, this is nothing. But as a monk, it didn't really, you know, I didn't really find it so enticing or inspiring. And so I thought, well, what is the meaning of Vesak for me, personally? Well, Sister Cecilia gave a very good talk about the meaning of Vesak, but she quoted several suttas, Mahaparinibbana Sutta and some other suttas, but I'm not going to speak from the perspective of the suttas. I'm going to talk about my personal take on the Buddha's life and the three primary events in his life that we celebrate on Vesak Day. The first one, of course, is his birth. And what is significant to me about his birth is, although you can read some embellishment of the Buddha's life, there's no statement in any place that he was born as anything else than a human being. Of course, he came from a Deva realm, but so do a lot of us. I mean, who knows where we came from? Some of you may have come directly down from Deva realms, including you, Chris. And some of us may have come up, you know, from very low realms. And a lot of people are just visitors here. They're here for a short time and then they go back down. The really good ones may go back up to a Deva realm. But anyways, the Buddha was nothing more or less than a human being, certainly with very fine qualities, you know, because we're all born with our own qualities, our own past karma. So that is the first part of the story. Nobody says he was the son of God or a prophet, you know, divinely ordained, anything like that. Just a human being, perhaps very sensitive, obviously. Sensitive, intelligent, compassionate, young baby, and then later young child. And as his life went on, of course, that sensitivity matured, and then he became aware of the suffering in human existence, and all of life, actually. And so he left his wife, his newborn son, and his home, and he went off to seek, to discover some kind of answer to this dilemma of the suffering of life. So he struggled and struggled and struggled. And being a monk, I know, I have a little bit of idea of what that's like. You struggle and struggle and struggle. Sometimes you tend to get off on a tangent, you know, you start going the wrong way. Then you have to correct yourself. You know, and that's what the Buddha did. You know, for a while he made very good progress, but then he found out that wasn't going to take him to the goal. And then he tried something else, self-mortification, starving himself, you know, torturing his body. And he later finally came to the conclusion, almost dead, that that wasn't going to work. So he sat, he meditated, and he came to enlightenment. So this, to me, is the crux of Vesak, because this is what makes a regular human being, a normal, well, perhaps not normal, but a human being, it turns him into a Buddha. Through his own effort, he was able to overcome all his mental defilements and realize the highest goal, arhatship. And of course, because of all his past good karma, he developed a lot of other powers along with that. But the primary thing is he realized the meaning of the Four Noble Truths. He understood them, realized it, completed that realization, and became fully enlightened. So this, to me, is the second part of why we celebrate Vesak. And he overcame Mara, which in this sense we could either consider Mara to be an actual being, like a devil or something, and no doubt there are beings like that in the world, in the universe, but in this sense it may be more his own inner defilements. So Mara has both those meanings. So after that, he was able to turn the wheel of the Dhamma. By the way, his first discourse was not given on Vesak Day. It was given 2 months later on the full moon day of July. But still, he wouldn't have been able to do that if he hadn't become enlightened. So Buddhism spread. 45 years later, after his enlightenment, as an old man, he'd done his job in life. He'd helped so many people. He established the Dhamma, the Sasana, set the wheel of the Dhamma rolling, established the Sasana. 45 years later, finally, his time had come. And it was time for him to give up his physical body and also his mental body. So, what is that? What is significant about that? You could say he died, but from the point of view of our understanding, at least my understanding of the Buddhist teachings, it's death only on a superficial level. Because death, as I understand it, for most people, leads to rebirth. But his death did not lead to rebirth. It is the ending of all existences, which means the ending of all suffering. So, some people say this is nothingness, but that is not the meaning of nirvana. The meaning of nirvana is, yes, it means extinction, but it also is defined as peace and bliss. You could say eternal happiness. The highest happiness. The highest pleasure in the universe. The highest goal. The summit of perfection is nirvana. And then parinirvana is when we've reached our goal. There's nothing more to do. So why keep this body? We don't have to come back again. We've accomplished our task. What that meant to me, personally, on a personal level, is that I saw, this was during the Vietnam War, back in the 60s, when I first read the Dhammapada and I started reading the Buddhist teachings. I said, oh my gosh, here's somebody who's telling me exactly what I'm feeling right now. There's so much suffering in the world. The world is just burning with suffering. People are killing each other for just out of greed, hatred, and delusion. There must be an answer. There must be an answer. And here's somebody who's telling me there is an answer, and he found the answer. Not talking about God, not talking about, you know, hell, our demons, our supernatural powers. He's just talking about the suffering that is so much a part of this world. And if we think it's not a part of this world, all you have to do is look around you. Look at your parents. Look at your friends. As you get old, one by one, they start dropping like flies. You know, we're not going to be around much longer ourselves. We're all growing older, day by day. The body's deteriorating. So, this is the fundamental teaching. A release from all this suffering, all this misery. And that's only the physical aspect of it. The mental aspect is 100 times worse. Because we multiply that suffering so much with all our mental defilements. I was inspired. I said, I'm a Buddhist. I said, I'm already a Buddhist. I want to become enlightened. At that point, I wanted to be a monk. That was back in 1968. I want to be a monk. I didn't even know Theravada Buddhism, Theravada teachings were still extant. I thought all Theravada Buddhists had died out, basically. Because the only thing I knew about was Zen. Everybody was talking Zen, Jack Kerouac on the road, Allen Ginsberg, beat Zen, beat this, beat Zen, you know, and then Zen was cool, you know, and it had come from Japan. So I searched that out. But I wanted to be a monk. Originally, I wanted to go to Japan. And finally, you know, after many, many years, of course, my karma ripened, my desire ripened after a number of disillusionments. And I found the Theravada teachings. I met Bhante Gunaratana at the Bhavana Society in the U.S. And I saw, this is a real monk. Because I had been a monk, actually, in the Zen tradition. But it just, It didn't work out at all. I mean, there was no guidance, no community support, no support at all. No one to guide us. No vows, no vinaya, nothing. So I figured this is the way I can best follow the teachings of the Buddha. I follow in his footsteps, follow his example. Now, let me just make something clear that that path is not for everybody. Because after all, there were, I don't know how many thousands of monks during the Buddha's time, but many, many more, perhaps millions of lay supporters during that time. So not everybody has to follow that path, because that is, although the Buddha calls it the middle path, you know, the way of the Sangha, I mean, you have to remember, back in those days, people were hanging themselves upside down on trees, you know, for days on end, and standing on one foot and starving themselves and piercing themselves with nails. So actually, it was a kind of middle path when you look at the kind of, you know, more self-mortification, ascetic practices that they were practicing then. Most people, it's just not their course in life to become monks. So they have a different path, slightly different path. That doesn't mean they can't practice the Buddha's teachings, but not in the same way. It's a different lifestyle. But for me, I just wanted to totally immerse myself in it. And I said, well, what did the Buddha do? The Buddha left his family. He left his wife, his beautiful wife. He left his young newborn son. He left a whole kingdom. He had inherited a kingdom. As I understand, he had already been crowned. He already had his coronation. So he left everything behind just in order to devote himself to discovering the truth. So I said, okay, if the Buddha could do it, why can't I? Well, I mean, you know, easier said than done. But still, I decided. I went to Burma, and I ordained. And then eventually, you know, my marriage ended, and I decided to kind of spend my whole life, you know, practicing the teachings of the Buddha in as thorough and complete a way as I could. And I thought that that's the best way I can do it, is to follow the example of the Buddha. Follow right in his footsteps. And when I was in Burma, it was really like that. You know, here, all these people, all these guys, and also women too, 150 nuns, 400 monks. Everybody, bald head, brown robes, and all following very similar, very good vinaya there. Nobody touched money there. Meditation, at least 7 or 8 hours a day, every day, minimum. And padimokkha, twice a month, full padimokkha, not just, you know.
What's that?
Padimokkha is the recitation of the rules of the vinaya. Is the recitation of the rules of conduct. That's the padimokkha. So I used to go up and sit in the meditation hall there. We would get eaten alive by bed bugs. I mean, that was the downside of it. But it was really amazing. I'd be sitting there with 200 monks right in the middle, mainly Burmese. And some of them are sitting there like rocks. I'm telling you, they don't move. They're like this 4 hours. Completely relaxed, though. And I'm sitting in the midst of this. I really, you know, it was really inspiring. I felt like I was back in the time of the Buddha. This has become my life now. And I'm not saying that I'm not just like you in a lot of ways, that I still don't have mental defilements. I've got a lot of defilements, you know. But I see that I want to dedicate myself to something that not only can help me, but ultimately I believe can help other people as well. This kind of brings me to the next aspect of my talk, which is the present state of the sasana, which I already mentioned to you briefly in the beginning when I talked about Kailaksi and the parade. I just want you to know that this is not just peculiar or unique to Kailaksi. Haloxi is Mahayana, but it's rampant in Theravada Buddhism also. I mean, when I was in Sri Lanka, I went to I was in the hospital, the Ayurvedic hospital, with one other monk. He was also in my same sect. He told me, he says, 5% of the monks in Sri Lanka, the real forest monks, follow the vinaya, that's follow the rules of conduct, don't handle money, don't eat in the afternoon, and meditate. The other 95% don't. And that is pretty much, maybe not to the same extent in Malaysia, but to a great extent. You know, I mean, if you go to a place like MBMC, of course they meditate, you know. But there are a lot of places where the monks don't meditate, mainly the temples. They do their chanting, they give a little Dhamma talk or something like that, and finish, you know, as long as they get their sustenance. It's their career. As long as they get the financial support, they have their devotees, they have their little bit of prestige, that's all they want. They're not searching for enlightenment. And this is the whole core of the Buddha's teaching, is that if you're a monk, you have one job. That's why I say it's different than a layperson. A layperson has family to support, has a job, has to support society, also has to support the Sangha, if the Sangha is to exist. But a monk, of course, secondarily a monk should be able to teach the Dhamma, right? But he has one primary job. And his primary job is to realize the Dhamma. Then you're in a position to teach it. How can you teach right view if you have wrong view? It can't be done. Okay, let's say you want to teach somebody to play the violin. Okay? If you don't know how to play the violin, how are you going to teach that person to play the violin? You can read as many books as you want, shows you how to hold your hand, and you can even get on the internet. Check it out on the web. You know, maybe there's some, Suzuki violin method for playing. You can say, oh yeah, you do it this, but you don't really know. It's like the discourse where the Buddha said, you know, how do you go from Rajagaha to Savati? Well, you take this, stop here, this, and finally get to Savati. But if you've never been to Savati, how are you going to tell them? So that's what most of the monks are doing nowadays. And then the Buddha warned about that. He said, look, he said, a lot of monks, they start to make progress in their practice, and then they come back to a temple, you know. They come back to the city, and the lay people start making all sorts of dumb. There's a sutta about this. The Buddha warns them, and then they get tempted. Tempted by the devotees, tempted by the adoration, the fame, the money, the clothes, the nice temple, you know. And so they just get carried away. And then it gets bigger and bigger and bigger, you know. Bigger temple, new complex here, new complex there. Pretty soon you're busy doing all sorts of administrative work. And pretty soon you've got a kaloxi.
With a cable car from...
We have to do our job, you know. Our job, and how can we best do that? In my opinion, the best way to do it is for a young bhikkhu who's beginning his training, or who has not completed his training, put it that way, is to go into the forest and live in the forest in seclusion, either alone or preferably with a good friend, or good friends. And that means fellow bhikkhus who are really practicing, real forest bhikkhus, like they talk about forest dhamma in Thailand. That kind of thing. And they also have that in Burma. That's what we need to do if we really want to get trained properly. And this is why I plan to go back eventually to Sri Lanka, up in the mountains, where I want to be with a really community that follows the Galdua sect, very strict vinaya, strictest one. With fellow bhikkhus, a lot of them foreigners, so the food isn't too spicy there. And we'll be practicing. And then they have a really good schedule. Now, there are other bhikkhus in Sri Lanka who go off into the forest and live alone. but because of my physical condition, I don't know if I can walk on Pindavata so far. So I'd rather be, at this point in my life, in a community, but a good one, in the forest. So a lot of the distractions of the city life, we don't have to deal with it. The temptations, all the... of course, it's still up to you, ultimately. Even when a bhikkhu gets up there, he can still spend all day sitting in the library, you know, reading various texts and not meditating. But at least, you know, there's an opportunity there, and there's encouragement, and there's other bhikkhus who are meditating there. And then, of course, if you break the precepts, if you commit an offense, it's very strict. You have to confess it. You've been purified of that particular offense. Of course, there's certain offenses that a bhikkhu cannot commit, like sexual intercourse. Once you do that, or killing another human being, purposely. Once you do that, you have to disrobe, and you cannot ordain again for the rest of your life. But that kind of support is what a bhikkhu, especially a new bhikkhu, needs, so he can progress in his practice. Then, when he develops himself, he becomes strong, his wisdom grows, and preferably, he gains some insight knowledge, and I mean deep insight knowledge, to the point where he actually sees the Dhamma, knows the Dhamma, is independent in the Dhamma, becomes independent in the Dhamma. At that point, he's a Sotapanna. Then, at least he has unshakable confidence in the Dhamma. Up until then, we can practice either Samatha or even Vipassana. But when we stop practicing, the defilements can come and overtake our minds. So, as clear as it is, it's not certainly not even anything compared to attaining path and fruition. So this should be the goal of every bhikkhu, to at least become a Sotapanna. And our ultimate goal should be arhatship. This is what we should actually strive for. This should be the goal. Because if we want to help people, we should not put the cart before the horse and think, well, I've got to give this Dhamma talk, I've got to set up this monastery. No. That is putting the cart before the horse. We should get things straight. Put the horse first. Once you're, you know, that's what I said at that during a Dhamma discussion one time. This is what Jetson Milarepa said. He said, don't worry about saving people now. He said, develop yourself spiritually first. Get enlightened. Don't worry. There will be no end to people to save. You'll always be able to help people. Get your own heads screwed on right first. Get rid of all your wrong views. Because if you have wrong views, they're going to distort the teaching willy-nilly. There's saying in Zen, when a man of wisdom explains a false teaching, it becomes true. When an ignorant person expounds a true teaching, it becomes false. Nowadays, we have so many scholar monks, scholar this, scholar that, and they're all writing about various subjects, you know, with tremendous emotion, you know, particularly now that this bhikkhuni thing has come up. Everybody's trying to prove their point. How many of them have real wisdom? These people who are so quick to put forward, you know, and make these historical comparisons, why don't they get wisdom first? With all that getting, get wisdom. Instead of just sitting there and arguing, you know, and carrying their banner for this cause and that cause, and getting into political issues, which are taking them further and further away from the truth, from the Dhamma. Why don't they worry about the fundamental thing? Let's get ourselves, our minds straight. When the mind is straight, the world will become straight. We'll see things clearly. Otherwise, we can't. And I'm going to read this because since it's a prediction, I want to make sure I quote it correctly. Actually, this is from the Anagatavamsa commentary. So it's actually a commentary. The decline of the sasana, how will it occur? After my decease, there will first be five disappearances. What five? The disappearance of attainment in the dispensation. That means any of the four stages of enlightenment. Sotapanna, Sakadagami, Anagami, Arhat. So that will disappear. Then comes the disappearance of proper conduct. That means that the people will not have any compunction about breaking sila, about committing the most heinous crimes, rape, murder, homicide. Some of that seems to be happening nowadays. Of course, it's always happened, but maybe we're just more aware of it. It seems to be happening on a bigger scale. The disappearance of learning. Learning. What do we mean by learning? It's not just, you know, getting a degree in business or accounting or something like that. It means understanding of the Dhamma. Disappearance of the outward form. The disappearance of the outward form, I'm not even sure what they mean by that. Maybe just the basic formalities of what it means to live in a society. You know, basic fundamental etiquette. And then the disappearance of the relics. Well, relics, of course, are the relics of the Buddha. So we'll just completely forget that the Buddha ever existed, you know. His teaching will be lost. The suttas will be lost. People just won't even remember. There won't be any place like, you know, Bodh Gaya, where the Bodhi tree is. It'll be completely forgotten. Then, according to Buddhaghosa, the decline of the sasana will occur over 5 1,000-year periods. So we're kind of in the middle. The first period is arhats with analytical knowledge. Analytical knowledge. There's 4 analytical knowledges. The analytical knowledge of meaning. That's the meaning of what things are. You understand what this is. The analytical knowledge of the Dhamma. If my understanding is correct, please correct me if I'm wrong. I believe the analytical knowledge of Dhamma is you understand the cause for things. You understand how they arise and how they pass away. The analytical knowledge of language, knowing how to speak in such a way so that you can be easily understood and your language is convincing and clear. And the analytical knowledge of perspicuity, which means knowing, in this case, it means knowing how to use all those other analytical knowledges at the proper time and occasion. So that's the first 1,000-year period, which is already gone. These are great beings like Sariputta and many, many others, Mahakachana, those who really knew how to preach the Dhamma with tremendous insight and clarity, you know, could explain things, who had such a profound understanding, you know, of the Dhamma, of the teachings. Then, after that, comes what they call the bare insight arhats. Well, I'm not sure bare insight would mean that possibly arhats without psychic powers about the meaning of that. I know there's one definition of bare insight, and it means they don't have the jhanas, but that there's some disagreement about that. Are certain jhanas. They wouldn't have the same ability to teach. Then the third one, then it goes down. Anagamis, Sakadagamis, Sotapanas. So that's the end of 5,000 years. Now we're in the third period, which means that there's maybe a few Anagamis still around. Yes. But even though they are rapidly disappearing, because we've already passed the halfway mark, I guess. Eventually, it's going to get to the point that people will not... No one will even have attained path and fruition. Then they'll lose jhana at that point. And so they won't even know what they're talking about. And there probably won't even be anything to talk about by that point. So where does the corruption begin? Where does the problem begin, the decline of the sasana? The Buddha had something to say about that. He said it starts within. The corruption, the decline begins within. Now where? If you talk about the sasana, how can it begin? The Dhamma doesn't get corrupted. The Dhamma is pure. Dhamma is not a person. The Buddha is only, at this point, we can't say. The Buddha is manifested at this point for us through the Dhamma. We remember the image, we remember the history of the Buddha. So he's symbolic. Historically, he's symbolic for enlightenment. So I don't think the Buddha got corrupted, unless the story of his life gets corrupted, which actually it has. But the Dhamma cannot be corrupted. The Dhamma is what it is. It's the law of the universe. It's the Four Noble Truths. Four Noble Truths is the Four Noble Truths. So where does the corruption begin? I'll ask you, does the corruption begin in the lay community, or does it begin in the Sangha of monastics?
It begins with all of us. Greed, hatred, delusion.
Well, of course, but we're talking about the corruption of the sasana. Obviously, we all have greed, hatred, and delusion. But the corruption of the sasana, the decline of the sasana, the Buddha said it begins within. It begins within our minds, right? Whose minds? Who's the Buddha talking to? He's talking to bhikkhus. I mean, what's the function of the bhikkhu? We, as bhikkhus, we are supposed to set an example for the lay community. That's our job. If you have a job, it's to support your family. It's to support society. It's to support the Sangha. Our job is, if anything at all, we should set a noble example for you. That's our job. If we don't set the right example, I mean, who are you going to know? Our job is to manifest the Dhamma in our lives. If we're not doing that, then the corruption is there. It's beginning within us. And if you see how the Sangha has gradually become corrupted till it's reached the point where have all the arhants gone? Long time passing. Where have all the arhants gone? Long time ago. Where have all the arhants gone? Gone to the deathless everyone. When will we ever learn? When will we ever learn? Where have all the bhikkhus gone? Long time passing. Where have all the bhikkhus gone? Long time ago. Where have all the bhikkhus gone? Gone to money, everyone. When will we ever learn? When will we ever learn? Where have all the Buddhists gone? Long time passing. Where have all the Buddhists gone? Long time ago. Where have all the Buddhists gone? Gone to wrong view, everyone. When will we ever learn? When will we ever learn? From my point of view, Buddhism is primarily, at its core, a transcendental teaching. It's a teaching of enlightenment. It's a teaching of freedom. It's a teaching of the ending of all suffering and the ending of samsara. And although we can say that there's a tremendous amount of benefit from making dana and practicing sila, that in itself is not the core of the Buddhist teachings, because that exists in other religions. You have that in Christianity, Islam, Judaism, Hinduism, all the other religions. They even have samadhi. I don't know if you can say right samadhi, but I mean, that's a debatable question. But still, they have samadhi, but they don't. What is unique about the Buddhist teaching is the teaching of wisdom. Anicca, dukkha, anatta. They even have anicca on some level, not on the microcosmic level of Buddhism, possibly, but on the level of, well, you're born and you die. Hey, you know, that's the way it goes. C'est la vie. But they don't really analyze it in the way that Buddhism does. So you break it down and you see how in every particle there's anicca, dukkha, and anatta. Then when you really see that, then that paves the way for total dispassion and the entering into the field of nibbana. We should strive to achieve what we have not yet achieved. And if we can do that, we can have a peaceful death. As for myself, as a monk, I really should do it. Because if I don't, I don't want to come to my final day when I take my final breath And I don't want to take that final breath with regret and remorse that I had not made the effort that I should have made as a bhikkhu. You all be well and happy. If there's any questions.
I think just that I was asking the class this word Hisak.
Hisak.
What does it mean?
You better ask the Pali expert. I only know what it means by context. I don't know what it actually means in Pali. The celebration of the Buddha's birth, his enlightenment, and his parinirvana, all on the same day, which historically maybe it didn't happen that way, but that's the way we celebrate. I can tell you how to know if one is not. If you see someone who does not follow the vinaya, who lies, who steals, who is greedy, who is interested in having relations with the opposite sex, of course, if he's a monk, then you can be sure that he's not enlightened. If he drinks, takes drugs. If he's a lay person, he can be a sotapanna and still have family. But if he goes out and cheats, which sometimes happens, takes advantage of his students, female students, then I think it would be highly questionable that that person is a sotapanna. I cannot myself give you some. I mean, the Buddha talks about unshakable faith in the Buddha Dhamma and Sangha and virtue. There are other qualities. Generosity is one quality, actually, for someone who is an Arya. Perfect sila. Well, I don't want to say perfect sila, but consciously, one does not go ahead and break sila. Maybe it happens incidentally. But as soon as he becomes aware of it, he or she, that person would immediately correct the mistake. Say, oh, I made a mistake, I'm sorry. They would realize the importance of how karma operates. They would not want to do that kind of thing. They can't do anything that's going to take them to a lower realm. They will not act in that way. So, that much we can know. I only know that being with my own teacher, Pawat Sayadaw, he would never say that he has any kind of attainment. Never, never. But I saw certain qualities in him that I say were not ordinary qualities. Very incredible tolerance, incredible peace just being around him. A lot of peace. I think there are some other bhikkhus like that too. I haven't traveled a lot, but some people, they may not necessarily be bhikkhus. I heard the same thing, actually, not to throw a monkey wrench into this talk, but I heard the same thing about Ramana Maharshi in India. He was a yogi. When people went to visit him, just to be in his presence, they experienced a tremendous peace. Their minds became quiet. So, wouldn't see as much anger. I mean, even if a sotapanna gets angry, it wouldn't last long. It wouldn't be as deep. Such a person wouldn't hold a grudge, most probably. You know, they'd let go of a lot of this kind of stuff. There was a interesting question that was asked to me. Someone asked me about, a nun asked me about the story about Anathapindika's daughter, who was his youngest daughter, who was a Sakadagami, second after Sotapanna, second stage of enlightenment. And she said, the book she read, the translation said that the daughter never got married and she became depressed, and then because she was depressed, she stopped eating and died. And I said to this, and she said she couldn't understand how could that happen to a Sakadagami. So I asked Pawat Sayadaw, I said, Sayadaw, is this true? He said, it's a mistranslation from the Pali. He said, it does say that she got sick, but it doesn't say that she was emotionally sick. It just says she became sick. It doesn't say why she stopped eating, only that she stopped eating. I mean, all the rest of that is projected, read into it by the translator, that it was emotional. The fact that she never married, you know, maybe she was a Sakadagami. She had very, very little sexual desire. Her joy was serving the Sangha. All the other daughters got married, but they were not Sakadagamis. They were Sotapannas. She had gone up one. Sakadagami is one who has greatly diminished sensual desire and anger. They're almost gone, but not quite. They're still there. But the strength of those passions is very, very, very slight. She may have been quite beautiful, but she just didn't have the desire. Her mind was very pure. And then Pawat Sayadaw said to me, he said, someone who has become a Sotapanna would never fall into mental depression. He said, it's impossible. He said, to have something, such a mental, emotional state so crude as to sit around feeling sorry for oneself. Sotapanna, sir, could get angry, maybe become lustful temporarily, but it would not have any power over one to maintain that state so that one would actually fall into some kind of depression or difficult emotional neurotic problem. It just wouldn't happen. That's what he told me. That's about all I can really tell you about. I mean, you know, they also say it takes a Sotapanna to know a Sotapanna. It takes a Sakadagami to know a Sakadagami. A Sakadagami can know another Sakadagami, but he or she cannot know if the other person is Anagami. And it takes an Arhant to know an Arhant. So if you become an Arhant, you'll know.
Finally, you mentioned about the decline of the sasana.
Yes.
It's quite frightening, actually. You think about it now.
Yes,
it is. And I think at least in our context now, Bodhihana, these spiritual friends are very important.
Absolutely.
Being together, you know, for the common cause, helping each other, supporting each other, you know, along the path. I think that is extremely important. Otherwise, if you swim alone, I think it's even more challenging, you know. Yeah.
Right. It's true. Some people can do it, but very rare, and I think it's getting rarer. Very rare nowadays. It's good to associate with other friends who have a common aspiration, who are on the path. I mean, that's why I said what I said about going to a monastery, because I'm a monk. So for me to be with other monks, to have that support, is vital. That's why the Buddha said, when Ananda said, ah, methinks, Lord, that Blessed One, that, you know, good friends, friendship is the half of the holy life. And the Buddha said, no, Ananda, do not say this. He said, good friendship is the whole of the holy life, is the entirety of the holy life. People are so naive, they think, well, I'm practicing, I've got equanimity, blah, 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 I can go into the bar, I'm a bodhisattva, I'll go into the bar, I'll save prostitutes, I'll save drug addicts. They don't know. They don't know their own minds, that the mind can be so easily influenced. You start hanging around with drug addicts and prostitutes and going to a bar and drinking with people. How are you going to keep your sati? Oh yeah, if you're an arhat, no problem. But if you're putujana, I mean, it's tough enough to keep sati even when you're in a good situation like Bodhihara, much less going out and associating with prostitutes and drug addicts and going to bars and gambling and trying to save the world. I mean, that's the Bodhisattva way. But I mean, that's what they say. But actually, fortunately, in Tibetan Buddhism, you have people like Milarepa. And they have a slightly different definition of the Bodhisattva. They believe in the enlightened Bodhisattva, which is not a possibility in Theravada Buddhism. But I won't question that. But for people to actually be so naive as to think that they're going to go off unenlightened, keep themselves from attaining nibbana, keep themselves from developing wisdom, insight wisdom. I mean, that should be our goal, is to develop wisdom. If we want to help people, people are lost in ignorance. How can you help people if you yourself are lost in ignorance? It's like somebody who's in a pit trying to pull somebody out of a pit. If you want to help them get out of the pit, then you can reach down with a rope or reach down with your hand and pull them out. Otherwise, we can't. So associate with good friends. I mean, that's why in the Mangala Sutta, the first blessing is not to associate with fools. So be happy that you've found good friends here in this community.
It is so important, Hunter. You made the distinction that Buddhism is one tradition of faith or religion that teaches wisdom far above anything else. Because you can find the rest in many of the religions that teach it. Really is. I see the significance. It's so important that we get the right view every time.
Yeah. It doesn't mean we should neglect the other, of course. But we shouldn't be just satisfied only to have the other. We should understand. This is the Buddha was always urging his disciples. You know, come a little bit further. Oh, you've given up this much. Okay, give this up too. Give that up too. Give that up. Oh, you've reached the fourth jhana. Give up the fourth jhana. Go to the first, go to the realm of, you know, the formless realms. Go to the formless realm of empty space. Go to the formless realm of infinite consciousness. Go to the formless realm. Each one, give up, give up, give up. Finally, the last one, you have to give up everything. All attachment.
The point I was going to make is that there's so many, in all the religions, you see, there's so many well-intentioned people in the world. Except that if you don't get the right view, they are doing all the good things, but at the same time, not thinking for themselves. Like giving up the right to think for themselves, to a deity, surrendering to a deity, something like that.
Sometimes they end up killing each other. It's true. We may end up experiencing a religious war before long if things keep on going the way they're going.
Except Buddhism, the teacher challenges you to think for yourself.
But I, of course, as you say, that's true. But at least we have to have four principles. We don't want to harm other people. We don't want to harm ourselves. If we can help other people and help ourselves, that's good. I mean, we all have to agree on that. If we can't agree on that, then we're not even worthy of being human beings. And we probably won't be human beings for long. We'll go down, for sure. If we can't even accept that much. Basic fundamental principles, do unto others as you would have them do unto you.
Yes. Your talk was very inspiring.
Thank you.